Now it is time for our presentation, which is entitled Not for the Weak of Heart, Virtual General Assembly 2020 by our UUA attendees. Six Prairie members attended. Prairie's delegates for the business portion of the assembly were Renee Deschard, Nancy Schraffnagel, and me. The other attendees were Mary Mullen, Morris Sidakario, and Patty Stocktale. The six of us planned this service together with the goal of giving you a sense of the meeting and to share a little of the inspiration we drew from it. All the elements of our service are drawn from our experiences at General Assembly. Each of us is going to present on some aspect of our learnings, starting with Nancy, whose section is entitled, We Have Problems. A UUA response. Nancy.
In spring of 2017, a hiring decision was made by the Reverend Scott Taylor, supervisor of five regional leads of congregational staff, for the Southern Regional Lead position. A white man was hired and Christina Rivera, a black woman, was overlooked. This action showed a contrast between our principles of affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of all people and acknowledge to the interdependent web of existence to the UUA's practices. The Commission on Institutional Change in the April 2018 report noted many long-standing issues and concerns, including white privilege, power structure, and white supremacy within the Unitarian Universalist Association. This occurred after decades of talk and no action. In hiring, power and privilege were based on race. There were a lack of shared goals in becoming a transformative multicultural association, and a lack of common understanding of systemic racism, sexism, heterosexism, ableism, and other oppressions. The UUA responses. The president resigned, and the association found three co-presidents and two co-moderators. There was more participatory shared leadership and more representation of people of color and other genders. The association funded Black Lives Unitarian Universalism, a $5 million grant project, and they also funded youth and young adult ministry. They changed bylaw amendments, gender-neutral pronouns inclusive, more interpretations of gender. Religious educators finally got to vote as delegates at the General Assembly. A youth trustee was placed on the board, and they said, if we get this right, we'll never go back to normal. I found over the last 3-4 years that the Unitarian Universalist Association response to change gave me great hope each year, and it still does. The organization underwent changes in leadership, in culture, and mentored and led others in the association and hopefully like me into hope. The theme of the 2020 General Assembly, rooted, inspired, ready. Rooted is grounded in Unitarian Universalist principles and theology and affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of all people and acknowledge the interdependent web of existence. Inspired, we are inspired by many actions that the Universalist Unitarian Association has taken over the history of its tenure. And inspired is who we yearn to become. Ready. Well, the pandemic gives us a contrast or a comparison. Who was ready for the pandemic? Yet people came forward and coped the best they could. We are dealing with a time with great urgency of needs. The time is now. In 2018, President Susan Frederick Gray talked about nurturing hope against a rhetoric of fear. This is no time for a casual faith.
Thank you, Nancy. Next, I will present on institutional change and individualism. In 2017, the Unitarian Universalist Association, which I will refer to as UUA, created the Commission on Institutional Change, which spent 3 years and thousands of hours evaluating systemic racism within Unitarian Universalism and creating a report that it called Widening the Circle of Concern. This report not only described problems, but also detailed recommendations for addressing these problems. The report was presented at General Assembly this year, but the whole conference was in many ways an outgrowth of the anti-oppression work of our Unitarian Universalist Association. There were many workshops on how to address oppression's multiple forms, including the entrenched class structure, systemic racism, history of colonialism with dispossession and annihilation of indigenous peoples, and marginalization of women, LGBTQ, and other gender nonconforming people. The workshops repeatedly emphasized how these oppressions operate within our congregations and within our individual unexamined biases to make us less effective in our work for justice in the world. Their recommendations are not just for the UUA, they are for us. The report from the Commission on Institutional Change recognizes that there are many factors working against success, and some of the biggest obstacles are going to be particularly difficult for Prairie to wrestle with. The UUA is not in charge of congregations. We UUs have a proud history of congregational polity, stemming from our Congregationalist roots in Puritan times, in which every local church congregation is independent, ecclesiastically sovereign, or autonomous. This means that our association cannot make us take on this work. Prairie UU Society is a congregation that has particularly prized its freedom from outside authority, and I would say inside authority as well. Yet that leaves us free to leave our biases unchecked, our various privileges unexamined, and our self-image as a welcoming congregation unchallenged. We can feel good about ourselves without actually doing the work. Congregational polity should call us to be in covenant with one another and make congregational decisions through the lens of our values. In Unitarian Universalism, we elevate freedom of thought to a core principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. However, we UUs often interpret this principle to mean that we are all free as individuals to think and act however we want. Prairie folks have a lot of opinions, and for the most part, we like it that way. However, we need to acknowledge that our particular culture of acceptance constrains us from challenging each other to become our best selves. And we are ill-equipped to deal in a healthy way with the inevitable conflict that would come from struggle to be our best. We don't hold each other accountable to strive to achieve the principles we proclaim. But to be most effective in the world, we will need to have common goals and act collectively. We need to educate ourselves and each other about the history and current systems of oppression and how our actions or inactions perpetuate these systems. in order to work towards equity and inclusion, we need to become more truly welcoming, to grow into the diverse and loving community we aspire to be. At this General Assembly, I learned that our leaders at the UUA are well ahead of us in moving toward truly living our principles. Prairie needs to catch up. I will end this section with a quote from the report. Our deliberations to date have convinced us of this. What is at stake is nothing less than the future of our faith. Next, Morris is going to present the way on the way of gratitude. Morris.
Thank you. Thank you. I think that this is an excellent follow-up to the concept of acting collectively that Rachel described. There will be a video following my brief introduction. So throughout this 59th General Assembly, several workshops and sessions said that UU people run the risk of relying too much on our rugged individualism and reason beyond reason. Our culture rewards and prizes individualism and self-reliance. But some contend that this actually keeps us apart from each other and decreases empathy. Self-reliance can work against the sense of gratitude and agitates against developing a new spirituality based on gratitude. This is why I chose to use Reverend Dr. Galen Gingrich's workshop as an example of the General Assembly. He is senior minister of New York's All Souls Unitarian Universalist Congregation. His book, The Way of Gratitude, A New Spirituality for Today, expands on gratitude and provides tools for us, such as First Light Meditations. He continues his thread as he speaks to us in the following video, which was used with his kind permission. We hear his church's choir midway in the video. Please clear your minds and hearts.
We are defined not by how we are independent of the people and world around us, but how we are connected to them. This claim happens to be true. Culture was built from the ground up to champion individualism, and modern technology has increasingly narrowed our modes of communication and entertainment until we are each an audience of one. But once in a while, something breaks through our culture of narcissism to remind us yet again that everything is made up of relationships. I become the air I breathe, the water I drink, and the food I eat. I become the longings that motivate me, the problems that beset me, and the possibilities that lure me on. I become the friends I treasure, the people I love, and the way of life I pursue. The way of gratitude is my effort to develop a spiritual practice and a way of life that aligns our priorities and our patterns of life with the way things really are. Building strength through ritual. That's what it is, Krista responded in response. It's a ritual. You do the same thing over and over again. It's how you get strong. She's right. It's how you get strong and it's how you stay strong. A ritual takes what is most important and puts it at the center of our lives so that we won't forget it or neglect it. This holds true whether you're talking about physical strength, emotional strength, or spiritual strength. You build strength through ritual. Spiritual practice is so called. It's a practice, something we do repeatedly. In my book, I advocate a daily practice that I call the First Light Meditation. Spiritual practice not only builds strength, it also helps us to nurture a spirit of optimism. Optimism happens to be the subtitle of Voltaire's 1958 novel, Candide, which recounts the adventures and misfortunes of young Candide, who was endowed at the start with everything necessary for a happy and successful life, but suffers the opposite, every conceivable misfortune, tragedy, and form of abuse. At the very end of the story, Voltaire suggests how one can, as he put it in his most famous phrase, crush the horror. He says simply, "We need to work our fields," or as it is often translated, "make our gardens grow." According to Voltaire, saving the world is like growing a crop. We need to work our fields. We don't need to work other people's fields or fields in different or better locations, but our fields. And we don't need to ponder our fields or exclaim how weedy they are or how poor the soil is or compare them with the best possible fields or the worst. The root meaning of the word optimism is power. The power to do the work that is ours to do. So if I would summarize what I describe as the way of gratitude, I would say three things. Everything in the universe is made up of relationships. Pay attention to the relationships that make you up, that make me up. Spirituality is about openness. Openness to our own minds and hearts, openness to other people, openness to the natural world. We tend to live our lives narrowly. We get focused on routines. And spirituality is about breaking through those routines and opening us up to the truth about the world around us, to what's terrible about the world and needs changing, and what's wonderful about the world and needs savoring. And as it applies to the things that need changing, the third thing I would say is that gratitude is the ability to look at problems and see possibilities, because it's an engagement with what is really true and what is truly real. And it sees clearly what needs to be changed, what must be changed.
Thank you, Morris. And thank you to Dr. Galen Goodrich. I just wanted to make a quick comment. Many of you may have noticed little boxes with initials showing up at the bottom of your screen. Throughout General Assembly, we had people chatting during the workshops, sometimes coming up with amazing comments, sometimes seeing the chat was annoying, sometimes it was very enriching. So it was interesting to have that layer always going on in the various workshops that you just got a tiny hint of by seeing those little boxes pop up. So next, Renee is going to be presenting on Indigenous social justice.
So one of the featured speakers at the General Assembly was Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and she spoke about her book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. I am not going to try and summarize a 300-page book in 5 minutes because that's impossible. I'm just going to mention a couple things. It was the UUA Common Read for 2019 to 2020, so basically this past year. And we're hoping that it will be a future Prairie Study Group book. So some of you know that we've started a new Prairie Study Group, and we're using books as jumping off points to have deeper discussions. Another featured speaker was, there were two, it was Debbie Reese and Jean Mendoza, and they actually adapted Roxanne's book. So it's called An Indigenous People's History of the United States for Young People, meant for middle school and teens. And they were part of the Sophia Foss lecture, which I had never heard of that name before. But Sophia Foss was, she led a revolution in UU religious education. So the speakers were talking about how their book, they were hoping would be used in schools to promote, you know, deeper discussions and look at the history, not from kind of the typical textbook standpoint. And again, I'm not going to summarize their 1 hour or 45 minute lecture or their book, but in the order of service, we have a resources kind of link towards the at the bottom. And I linked, it's called Reflecting Critically on Teachings About Native People. And Debbie Reese and Jean Mendoza created that. It has tons of great links and information. It's organized by the 7 UU principles. So if you're interested in more, I highly encourage you to go ahead and check that out. Another thing I wanted to mention was the land acknowledgement that we did at the beginning of today's service. So I had never actually heard of land acknowledgements until the General Assembly. And one thing is that this is something we need to look more into, because if we just put a land acknowledgement at the beginning of each service without any kind of underlying social justice actions, then it just becomes a superficial kind of thing, which they talked about at General Assembly. So that's something, again, I'd like to see Prairie kind of delve deeper into and discuss more in the future. So those are just a couple of the highlights with that.
Thanks, Trinae. Mm-hmm. And now I invite Mary to present on anti-racist conversations.
Hey. Well, Mary Mullen here with just a few minutes to talk to you about a very stimulating workshop that I attended at GA. It was called Having Anti-Racist Conversations and Inviting to Action. And it was delivered by Chris Crass. And I'm going to try to show you what he looks like. He's a UU. He's from Kentucky. And he gives workshops all over the country. And he has a book also that we could use in our study group that's starting up. The first book we're reading is White Trash. And I think our first meeting is in September. But his is called Towards the Other America. And it greatly expands upon what he talked about at GA. I've read a little bit of it. It's 180 pages. Well, today I plan to talk to you, just expand on 3 points from the workshop. One thing that he pointed out is now is really an excellent time to have these anti-racist conversations. Second, he suggests concentrating your conversations on the passive anti-racist, that would be somebody like me, and the movable middle, people that are maybe open to listening to talking about anti-racism. And he also said, aim to make the racist less effective. And third, to use your emotions to get energy and to keep on track. Well, so now is the ideal time. Well, what makes this the ideal time to have an anti-racist conversation? Well, after watching George Floyd's death on TV and the demonstrations all over the United States and, in fact, the world, a lot of white people are questioning, well, what can I do? These days, in just a week, consciousness can change, just in 7 days, whereas it might have taken 7 years without all these events that have just happened. One attendee called this a liquefied moment. It's when a white person suddenly becomes open to taking just a baby step ahead to promote racial justice. So the first job is to recognize this liquefied moment in your friends or relatives, to praise that person that's newly become aware, and then to give them recognition for what they've recognized. And then the next job is to help them figure out where they can go from here. Maybe it's giving money. Maybe it's putting out a Black Lives Matter sign. Maybe it's maybe even more important to attend a talk about this or a demonstration, or maybe provide support for demonstrators. And then once a person starts to take action, then their experiences teach them further about how to be anti-racist, and you're kind of off the hook then. The second thing I'd like to talk about is how to concentrate on the passive anti-racist and the movable middle. Chris pointed out that our tendency might be to start engaging the worst racists on Facebook, and that's what I've done, or among friends, but that would be wasting your energy. He gave an example of his own grandfather who had it at the dinner table when they'd have lots of people over, maybe 20 people at the table, the cousins and everybody else. He would monopolize the table with anti-racist or anti-feminist remarks. And Chris came to realize that his best goal with his grandfather was to make his grandfather's racist opinions less effective, rather than try to convince his grandfather to change his stripes, because that was never going to happen. So he did this with humor, he said, and then he would turn to all the cousins and everybody else in the table and ask them to talk. And that was really effective, you know. His grandfather wasn't talking anymore, and all these people that had other experiences and other opinions were. In other words, don't give the floor to the person who will keep people from acting. Those people might be those who want to argue forever about the term white supremacy, or they would suggest maybe that all lives matter would be a better sign to put out than Black Lives Matter. Or they might just want to spend a lot of time arguing about, well, is this the right time to do this? He also said, well, pick a person to talk to about their attitudes, somebody who cares about you, because they'll be more likely to listen to you. And then my third take home from this workshop was about the value of emotion as an engine for energy and for keeping on track. When people were asked to share their experiences during this workshop, Chris would keep asking, well, how did that make you feel? And he would just keep repeating, how did that make you feel? And it's really hard to get many Unitarians to talk about how they feel. They want to talk about what they're going to do instead. One man shared how his Black friend said that whenever his children left the house, he worried that they wouldn't come back. And Chris kept after that man who shared until he finally got him to name his feeling. He said, well, I was heartbroken when I heard this. And another woman talked about how she had been dating a Black man, and he was out in her driveway fixing her car, and she went into the house to look for something. It took her a little longer than she thought it would. And when she came out, she found her neighbor pointing a gun at this Black man who was helping her fix her car. And this neighbor thought he was stealing her car, of course, because he was Black. And finally, Chris, in saying, how did you feel? How did you feel? She finally admitted she felt horrified at this. So it's emotions like these and thinking of these incidents that made you have, you know, feel something and recalling these that can keep you energized and focused. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Next, Patty is going to be presenting A Minister's Journey. Patty.
Thank you. So I went to a number of workshops, and one of them was presented by Reverend Dr. Kiyama Raman. And we have a photo of her. No. There she is. Thank you. She's much nicer looking than I am. I really enjoyed listening to her. She was presenting about her book. She wrote an anthology, or gathered an anthology, called Summoning Our Sheroes, The Presence of Black Women in Unitarianism, Universalism, and Unitarian Universalism. And but she had a very interesting journey herself, and the title of her workshop is called Climbing Up the Rough Side of the Mountain. And she didn't really refer to the title of her workshop, but I looked it up, the lyrics, and listened to the tune. And since it's a spiritual hymn, and it's about trying to keep your faith and, you know, move along and stay spiritual. And basically, really, that was her life. She grew up in a Baptist family, and her father was a minister, and she learned Christianity pretty strongly. And then once she finished high school, went to college, she started questioning that. She said that her young life, she didn't learn critical thinking. So she was like trying to bring critical thinking into her life. And she went into a stage of her life called God is Dead. And so she became like a Marxist-Leninist after she graduated from college and traveled to Cuba and worked in camps building homes just for a few months. And when she came back, then she entered her, you know, another questioning stage, and then she became a practicing Muslim and was very attracted to Islam because of its principle and upright tenets of self-determination and word was bond and black pride and many other ones. But then she became to feel somewhat challenged by it. She says in general that Christianity gave me my religious foundation, including Jesus and sacraments such as prayer, worship, and giving. Islam gave me the discipline of studying, of praying five times a day, piety, and sisterhood. When the Islam prohibitions as women and mother became too restrictive and no longer allowed me to express fully who I was, then I moved on. She also felt like her kids at the time were experiencing peer pressure, that she didn't want them to feel alienated and to experience another level of bias. So she entered a non-denominational stage in her life, and then she started going to Quaker meetings, and then she saw signs posted about Unitarian Universalism. She's living in Atlanta, Georgia. And so she started attending UU churches, and she found one that she really liked, the Thurman Hamer Ellington UU Church. So she attended the church, and finally she went to her first GA in 1993, and she just loved it. And she said that she came to Unitarian Universalism because of a number of reasons, and one of them was that there was a community that was willing to disagree. So at this particular GA, the theme of it was the 250th anniversary of Thomas Jefferson's birth. And the theme and it was in the UUA's Thomas Jefferson district. So they were having an event that was called Come Dressed as somebody from that period. So she was appalled because that would mean that she would come dressed as a slave, you know, in shackles and rags, you know. And people started to protest at the GA. And she said she took that as a positive because, as she said, she was drawn to Unitarian Universalism as a willingness to disagree. So she was able to feel that that was a good place for her. She wanted to be able to disagree. And then another, so then also she said that while she was there, she was noticing the banners and kind of taking them in. And a famous black minister, whose name is Mark Morrison Reed, who also wrote a book called Black Pioneers in White Unitarian Universalism, came and spoke to her, and they didn't know each other, and she was inspired by his encouragement to like pursue UUism, and you know, from there she decided that she would go into the ministry. And she thought the Unitarian Universalism allowed her to bring in a number of different ideologies and religions into her thinking. So, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. And from there, she's been able to change and develop and grow her religion. So I thought she was just a wonderful person. But she did write this wonderful book. As I said, it's an anthology, Summoning Our Sheroes, the Presence of Black Women in Unitarian Universalism and Unitarian Universalism. And she said she was she didn't see any real information about women clergy, black women clergy. And as I said, she was familiar with Mark Morrison Reed's book, Black Pioneers in White Unitarianism, but it was about the Black clergy. So she wanted to write about women. And so that's her book. It's going to be out at the end of this year, the beginning of next year. And it's a book of essays, and it might behoove us to read the book or some of the essays, especially on our pursuit of looking for a minister. And I do have a lot of quotes from different parts of that book, but I won't go into them because of time. But I certainly was inspired by her workshop.
Thank you very much, Patty. So, in summary, we who attended the General Assembly this year came away inspired and motivated to work for change and to do that work here at Prairie with you. That work will involve listening, learning, reflection, discussion, and taking action within and outside of our community. Are you interested in growing our congregation in wisdom, welcome, and love? What ideas do you have about how to build the beloved community? Prairie has taken some steps down this path with an increased focus on anti-racist and anti-oppression work in our choice of presenters at Sunday services, and you should see some of that coming up. We are starting a study group on understanding the intersecting oppressions of class, race, gender, and colonialism. We will meet twice monthly starting next month. Please talk with each other and let your board members know how you believe we can best engage in this work together. Ours is no caravan of despair. It's an opportunity for creativity, discovery, and progress toward our vision of what Unitarian Universalism can be. Join us.